Well, it is good to see everybody here this morning. I was sick for about half the week this week, so the voice is just not quite recovered. I feel fine, and I'm excited to be preaching this morning, but I hope you'll forgive me if the volume isn't quite what it normally is and if I have to get a little bit of aquatic help here and there throughout the lesson. Please have your Bibles open to Ephesians chapter 5, and we're going to notice several verses from Ephesians chapter 5 this morning. Go ahead and place a bookmarker there, as we'll be getting to that particular passage here in just a few moments. By way of introduction, I'm going to be referring to a pretty striking recent news event. Unless you were hiding under a rock, then you knew that a couple weeks ago, armed gunmen entered a staff meeting for a French satirical magazine in Paris, opened fire and killed 12 people. The reason why they killed 12 people that particular day, the reason why they were targeting that French satirical magazine, is because the magazine had a tendency to run articles and cartoons that they considered to be blasphemous to the Prophet Muhammad. Which got me thinking about sarcasm, humor, crude or otherwise, and just what sarcasm and humor can do to people. I hope you'll understand that as we go through this lesson, this is a very challenging one for me personally, because you know my sense of humor is one that's couched deeply in sarcasm. I do like wit. I like to laugh at the things that I find ironic in this world. And every now and then, that sense of humor of mine can get me into some trouble. Though I do hope that in my lifetime, I think Rebecca would agree with this, that my sarcasm never causes me to be at the bad end of a firearm. How we use our language is one of the most profound ways to show just what's going on in our hearts. What we say is an indication of what's going on the inside. And sometimes what we say can lead other people to respond in some very incredibly violent and negative ways. As Jesus says and has already been read earlier in the worship service in Matthew chapter 7, verses 16 through 20, you'll know people by their fruits. He goes on to explain that if you have a bad tree, it's going to produce bad fruit. And if you have a good tree, it will produce good fruit. And you'll know them by their fruits. Our language, then, is almost like the fruit dangling off the branches of our lives. If all we ever say are bad things, harsh sarcasm, criticism, crude language, then why should we believe, why should we expect anybody else to think that what's in our heart is anything but bad? If we produce good things, good language, things that are uplifting and encouraging, then that would be an indication of what's going on in our hearts as well. Another passage that I think very tragically illustrates just what happened a couple weeks ago is in James chapter 1. And we don't have time to read the entire passage, but if you'll turn to, James chapter 3. But if you'll turn to James chapter 3, and in particular, notice some of the language here as he describes the tongue and the damage that the tongue can do and how just uncontrollable it is. He says, the tongue is a fire, the word of iniquity. So is the tongue among our members, that it defiles the whole body, and it sets on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire by hell. And he goes on to say of the tongue being tamed, that nobody can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil and full of deadly poison. Now, we'll add one caveat here, one side note. There's nothing that can justify what the terrorists did to those staff writers and editors and police officers in Paris. Absolutely nothing justifies killing people. No matter what they're writing, no matter how blasphemous their cartoons are, nothing justifies that. And so I don't bring up this example from the news because I want to poke fun at it, because I want to pull on a fresh wound or anything like that. But I do think it illustrates the power of our words. This example from the news illustrates just exactly what James 3 is talking about. that how we use our language can set the world on fire. It can change our lives forever. It can destroy relationships. We can lose our jobs because of it. We can ruin our marriages because of it. We can even, in some of the most extreme cases, we can lose our lives because of the things that we say. So yeah, it's easy for us to say sticks and stones can break your bones, but words can never hurt you. It's easy for us to say that. But I don't think that's a very true statement in real life. Sticks and stones can break my bones, but words can hurt me most of all, I think is a more accurate way of putting it. Whether it's the words that I say that cause somebody else to hurt me, or any other way that you can twist that around. We need to take our words seriously. Every word that we say, even the words that make us laugh, can be very destructive to us. Which is where we get to Ephesians chapter 5. For context, I'll go ahead and start in verse 1 because I think it's worth our time to notice the lead up to verse 4, which is where we're going to spend most of our time here. But notice, in Ephesians chapter 5, beginning in verse 1, "Therefore be imitators of God as beloved children," which is really important. You know, when you realize that the Bible did not originally have these chapter breaks, they didn't have the verses and the chapters. It was a continuous thought. When you look at the end of chapter 4, I think it explains the meaning of chapter 5 and verse 1. When he says, put away, at the end of chapter 4, put away bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, slander, all of these things along with malice. And do what? What do you replace them with? Kindness and mercy, tenderheartedness, forgiveness. So, be imitators of God as beloved children. Notice verse 2. "And walk in love just as Christ also loved you and gave himself up for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God as a fragrant aroma. But do not let immorality or any impurity or even greed be named among you as is proper among saints. Let there be no filthiness and silly talk or coarse jesting, which are not fitting, but rather giving of thanks." There's an ideal here that should exist in every Christian. It's not just that we need to abstain from evil. I like the way he puts it. It should not even be named among us, like it says in verse 3, as is proper or as is becoming for saints. Now, this is where the practical application gets really, really challenging for us. There's a lot of TV shows out there that are very, very funny. But do you ever find yourself kind of justifying the way that you view them? You're like, it's so funny, and if you ignore all the bad language, it's just great. Well, it's, you know, every episode is so great, but they've got to have like 30 seconds where they got to throw in a dirty joke every now and then. But if you ignore that, it's really, really humorous. Oh, it's so funny. I don't know. When you got to spend like all this time justifying or like excusing it, like, oh, it's so funny except for this and except for that. And if you ignore that part of it, it's just so good. Maybe you kind of go like, if most of the show you've got to spend like justifying even watching it, maybe you shouldn't even be watching it in the first place. Don't let immorality or impurity even be named among you as is proper or becoming for saints. That is a very, very easy thing to read and a very, very hard thing to apply. Humor's tricky like that, isn't it? Because we feel so good when we're laughing at something, a TV show, a joke, or a comedian or something. We feel so good laughing at something, it's hard for us to feel bad about all the stuff that's in there that's inappropriate. Yeah, but he makes me laugh so hard. Yeah, but it feels so good. Yeah, but it's so funny. Anything that puts a smile on your face certainly can't be that bad. Okay, well, let's look more specifically at Ephesians 5 and verse 4. And let's look at what Paul is actually talking about here. Now, again, I'm not bringing all this up and being so practical about it because I think you've got such a problem with it. Maybe I'm so practical with it because I've got to watch out in my life the way that these things creep in. And again, in the TV shows that we watch and the stand-up comedians that we listen to and even the kind of jokes that we tell to each other or our coworkers or our family members. He starts off by describing filthiness, Now, the definition for the filthiness here, according to a commentary on Ephesians that I was reading, is dirty, indecent, or obscene language. It's shamefulness, obscenity, and nastiness. Of course, some people try to confuse the issue by saying that what's obscene for you is not obscene for me, that we all have kind of like different standards. I've actually heard Christians try to say, well, surely, you know, there's stuff you'd say around your grandma and stuff you wouldn't say around your grandma. And I kind of look at that like, well, where's the baseline then? What's the minimum standard then? I don't know. If you're not willing to say it around your grandma, maybe it's not something you should say around anybody. To me, that's not a very good justification, that what's obscene for you is not obscene for me. And we've all got different standards, and I just kind of respect your line and you respect my line. Here's the funny thing about that. Even in a secular sense, does the world agree what is a swear word and what is not? Does even the world agree on what is a swear word and what is not? Yes. Because when you look at all the ratings on movies, some mild language, the very fact that somebody out there, or an organization of people, the very fact that somebody out there could watch a movie and definitively say there is some mild language means that something out there is mild language, right? It means that even a secular organization can recognize that these words in this list are mild or offensive language. Even secular organizations can recognize that. And why is it that we seem to have a pretty standardized list of what are swear words and what are not swear? We all know what the swear words are. I'm sorry to say it, we all learned them in like third grade, okay? We all know what the swear words are. So when you try to tell me, well, what's obscene for you is not obscene for me. No, even the world agrees. There's a list of words out there that we all agree are swear words. And when you include those words in your language, you're swearing. Even the world agrees on that. So I guess I just don't buy it when you're trying to kind of like argue your way out of what is filthiness or shamefulness or obscene language. Then he says foolish talking. Foolish talking is defined as impious, silly, godless speech without forethought and wisdom. It reminds me of Psalm 14, verse 1. What does the fool say in his heart? Psalm 14:1 gives you like, you want to know what foolish talking is? Here's what fools say. Foolish talking is, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. You know what foolish talking is? Foolish talking is Ecclesiastes chapter 10. Look at what it says in Ecclesiastes chapter 10, beginning in verse 12. Words from the mouth of a wise man are gracious, while the lips of a fool consume him. Consuming words, destructive words. Those are foolish words. But look what he says in verse 13. The beginning of his talking is folly, and the end of it is wicked madness, yet the fool multiplies words. So maybe one way that you could see foolish talking here in Ephesians 5 and verse 4, abundant words that don't mean anything. When you're just filling your life with talking, jabber, 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 it's foolish talking. When you're making circular arguments and you spend all day long trying to argue one little tiny thing in theology or the definition of a little word here and there, that's foolish talking. When you're spending all of your time sipping coffee and stroking your beard and philosophizing about the meaning of the world and what does that... That's foolish talking because it's empty, it's abundant, and it's meaningless. The fool starts off with foolishness, and he keeps on talking. He multiplies words until it turns into wicked madness. That's foolish talking. I think a practical application for the Christian is be very, very careful about what you're arguing. Be careful what you're arguing about. If we're spending all our time in a Bible class nitpicking a little word here in the Bible and getting frustrated with each other, we might be going into the realm of foolish talking. If you've got your little like pet hobby topic over here, and all you ever study is that one topic, and you obsess over it, and you've got a whole room full of books on it, and that's all you ever want to talk about. And every Bible class, you're always raising your hand, trying to figure out some way of working in your little hobby topic into Bible class. That might be foolish talking. Be very, very careful. Foolish talking is easy to fall into. He says coarse jesting next. Coarse jesting is the idea of suggestive jesting or coarse jokes. It would be the use of polished and witty humor as an instrument of sin. One writer in a book called Word Studies from the New Testament said, sometimes it's lodged in a sly question, in a smart answer, in cunningly diverting or cleverly retorting an objection, or in lusty hyperbole, in a plausible reconciling of contradictions, or in acute nonsense. I like that, acute nonsense, kind of your little oxymoron of the day there. I kind of see the use of like double entendres as coarse jesting. You know, it's jesting, so it sounds smart. That's the thing about jesting, is when you're jesting, you're saying something that's kind of smart. You know, it's clever, it's witty, it's, you know, why did the chicken cross the road sort of thing. Because that's real smart, you know, isn't it? But the idea of jesting is trying to be smart, trying to seem real clever about something, twisting words around with double meanings, but it's also coarse. And that's the other part to it. It's not just jesting. It's coarse jesting. We've got to be so careful about that, don't we? Every one of us, from the most pious to the least pious, it's so tempting to make jokes of a crude nature. Especially if we can be clever about it, or kind of cover it up a little bit, put a thin coat of paint on it, put a thin veneer on it, and make it sound like a smart joke. Make it sound like it's really clever. But in the end, if your joke is dependent on sex or toilet humor to get the point across, you're not being smart. It's not smart. It's coarse jesting. And this is the practical application. This is where those TV shows come in. I have a hard time watching any sitcom, I'll be honest with you. And, you know, I like a sitcom. I like a comedy show. I like to sit and laugh at a TV show. But you know what? The first time they tell a joke, I turn the channel. I can't stand it. The first time they tell a joke, it ruins me. One of my favorite radio stations is the stand-up comedy station here in Phoenix. And I have a policy. The first dirty joke out of their mouth, I change the channel. They don't get a second strike. They don't get a second at-bat. There's no second tries here with me. The first dirty joke I hear, it's off. That's coarse jesting. We can't let that stuff into our lives. The more you let it into your life, I think the more it starts to show in your own life and in your own language. But rather, he says, giving of thanks. I like that God always gives us an alternative. It's not just don't do this and don't do that and don't do that. He doesn't just give us a list of all the things we're not supposed to do. God says, let me give you an alternative. Let me give you something positive to fill the void. If you're not going to listen to that comedian or watch that TV show or say that joke, let me give you a suggestion of what you could be doing with your language and your time. But rather, giving of thanks. And the great thing about giving of thanks is that it reminds us to be grateful for the things that we once were insulting and making fun of. Take sex, for example. Why should sex be the point behind all of our culture's humor? Where every sitcom and every stand-up comedian has to have sex as the point of his humor. Does that seem very grateful to you? To make that the object of our humor? I think what God would say is, rather than using that as the object of humor, rather than always using that in your jokes, rather than making that the point of your humor, why not give thanks for the things that I've done? Instead of making fun of the human body, instead of making fun of relationships, instead of making fun of God Himself in irreverent and blasphemous humor, rather, give thanks for the things that God has done. Take note before we move on to our next point. Take note in 1 Peter chapter 3, the role of thanksgiving here. in 1 Peter chapter 3, beginning in verse 8. To sum up, he says, let all be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit, not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead. For you were called for the very purpose that you might inherit a blessing. But look what he says here, quoting from Psalm 34. Let him who means to love life and see good days refrain his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking guile. Let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it. You want to have a long and fulfilling life? You don't have a long and fulfilling life by being insulting or sarcastic or rude or disgusting. You have a long and fulfilling life by turning rather to the good things and using your lips to thank God for all that he has done for us. So hold on a second there, Ryan. You're a pretty sarcastic person there, aren't you? Does this mean that we're not allowed to tell jokes at all? Does this mean that God wants us to live kind of that monastic lifestyle? But just kind of like refrain from all humor, never smile, never give the devil an opportunity, even through a chicken crossing the road joke. No. Let's kind of think about this idea here. Ephesians 5 verse 4, I believe, in no way prohibits the use of jokes and even sarcasm in a certain way in our language. We just have to understand what its place is and what its purpose is. God is not against laughter, after all. In Ecclesiastes 3 and verse 4, in that great chapter on how there's a time for everything, he does say in Ecclesiastes 3 verse 4 that there is a time for laughter. So God acknowledges there's a time to be funny. There's a time to make jokes. There's a time to revert to humor to get our point across. And I would even say, and I'm not defending Charlie Hebdo, by the way, because the comics that they were running were incredibly blasphemous. They were incredibly inflammatory. But I would say, satire, sarcasm, humor can sometimes get a truth across to a person more than anything else can. Because when you can get a person to laugh and think about something at the same time, I think you've given them something to think about that will stick and that will last. But one writer put it really well, I think, in kind of describing kind of the balance that you need to find. He said, the words here in Ephesians 5 and verse 4 do not preclude spontaneous Christian joy or a sense of humor, but they indicate that Christians are not to indulge in empty frivolity. In the Greek, they connote the sort of jesting that is vulgar and unclean. The antidote for the Christian is thanksgiving. Now, I think it being pretty clear here that Ephesians 5 is talking about being flippant, being blasphemous, and being crude when it comes to your humor. If you can be funny without being any of those things, then of course God does not have a problem with our humor. What about free speech, though? Am I not allowed to say what I want, when I want? Am I not allowed to say whatever is on my mind? After all, freedom of speech and freedom of expression is an incredibly valuable thing in our culture. In our culture, it's probably one of the things that we would defend most ardently. It is a part of our Constitution. It is a part of our heritage. We believe it's a part of our birthright as Americans to say and do, to write, to draw whatever we feel like. Now, I'm not going to deny that. I'm not going to deny that we live in a country that guarantees people the right to say what they want, even if it is stupid, even if it is vulgar, even if it is offensive. I'm not going to argue against that. I guess my question would be this. As a Christian, does your obligation as a Christian mean more to you than your rights as an American to just say whatever you want? Ooh, boy, we love being American first, don't we? It's more fun being an American than being a Christian. I'm an American and then a Christian. It's more fun that way, isn't it? We can justify so many more things when we live like that. But I guess, what's your perspective? Are you a Christian first or are you an American first? Because if you're a Christian first, then you will never take your freedom, you'll never take your rights to an offensive degree. So sure, satirical magazines can say and write whatever they want. Comics and cartoonists can draw whatever they want, and that's fine. They have freedoms that are guaranteed, legally speaking, in the countries where they live. But the Christian has a higher calling than that. Your freedom has to be dictated. Your freedom has to be hemmed in by your first and foremost obligation to God. Turn to Galatians chapter 5. Notice two verses here in Galatians 5. We'll skip from verse 1 to verse 13. And notice what the Christian's obligation is. It was for freedom, he says in verse 1, that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery. I mean, you have two choices, freedom or slavery. There's nothing in between, right? Those are two things that are exclusive. You are either free or you are enslaved. You cannot be anything in between, and you cannot be both. You're set free. It was for freedom that Christ set you free. Don't turn around and be subject again to that yoke of slavery. But look at verse 13. Add this idea to verse 13. You were called to freedom, brethren. Only do not turn your freedom into an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. So yes, you're free to say whatever you want. I know. I'm not saying that that's exactly what Paul's trying to say. That's out of context, okay? He's not talking about humor here, obviously. He's not talking about rights that are guaranteed by the Constitution, but I'm taking the language and trying to make a point here to you. Yes, you're free. You're free to say and do what you want in this great country of ours. And I wouldn't have it any other way. Because for as much freedom as we have to be vulgar and offensive, we also have the freedom to be pious and righteous and to worship God without harassment. I wouldn't want it any other way. But for the Christian, how are you going to use your freedom? Are you going to use your freedom to say and do what you want and what you feel like? Or are you going to use your freedom as an opportunity to serve one another through love? Remember what James 1 and verse 19 says. Let everyone be quick to hear, but slow to speak, and slow to anger. Everyone be quick to hear, but slow to speak, and slow to anger. I wish that we had a little bit more time to go through Romans 14. It's something that was included in my notes, but I'm nearing the end of what my voice is capable of producing today. But I will give you this. When you read in Romans chapter 14, the first half of Romans chapter 15, I think we kind of have this gut feeling that all he's talking about there is just celebrating holidays and whether to eat meat or not. There's a deeper lesson that he wants the Christian to learn there from that chapter, though. It's not about meat or not meat. It's not about celebrate the holiday or don't celebrate the holiday. It's about do you love each other? Do you love each other so much that even if you're free to do something, even if you're free to say something or eat something or practice something, that if it causes offense, you would cast aside your freedom for the sake of your brother or sister in Christ. That's the deeper lesson behind Romans 14. He says, in this way you ought to love each other. In this way you ought to serve each other. Are we willing to do that in our language as well? The last point that we'll make this morning is this. Turn to Matthew chapter 12 and verse 36 and see what Jesus has to say here. In Matthew chapter 12 and verse 36... So I say unto you, that every careless word that men shall speak, they shall render account for it in the day of judgment. For by your words you shall be justified, and by your words you shall be condemned. Careless words. That's a hard one for me. You know, you think you've heard some bad stuff out of my mouth every now and then, as far as preacher standards go. We can laugh about it now. You should have heard me preach about 10 years ago. The flavor of foot just was in my mouth constantly. Stick your foot in your mouth, you know what I'm saying? I hope you got that. I don't taste foot in my mouth all the time. So that's good use of humor right there. Careless words are real hard, though, because they're the things that we say in the heat of the moment. They're the things that we say when we feel something right then and there. A snap judgment. When you see a person dressed in an outfit and you've just got to say something about it. You've got to be really careful about those careless words. Jesus takes them very seriously. Jesus takes careless words so seriously that he says, it's because of those careless words. It's because of those things that you say in the heat of the moment. Whether you bridle your tongue or let it run wild, those are the things by which you're going to be judged. And I think it's interesting. God is not going to judge us by the things that we have rehearsed. God is not going to judge us by a script that we memorize when we get up to the judgment day and say, well, God, it's good to see you. I believed and I was baptized and I did everything I was supposed to do. No, God says you're not going to be judged by the stuff you've rehearsed. You're going to be judged by the stuff you said in the heat of the moment. The stuff that just popped out of your mouth. Those gut reactions, those quick snap judgments, those things you wish that you hadn't said and you refused to repent of because you were too stubborn or too arrogant or you thought you were too smart for your own good. Oh, those careless words. Those are the things that really set the fires. Like James chapter 3 says, the whole world is set on fire by our words. The course of humanity, the course of your life personally, can be altered irreparably because of the things that you say. I honestly believe that for most Christians at least, we don't set out in the morning to say offensive things. We don't mean to say something that's cruel. And I honestly think we don't wake up in the morning thinking I'm going to say something rude or offensive or crude today. Trust me, the times that I've made mistakes, I don't write it in my notes to say things that are offensive or weird. I don't script that stuff. And I don't think you do either. I don't believe that you do either. Which just shows all the more how every day that we get up, every time we present ourselves to the world, every time we get ready to show who we are to believers and unbelievers alike, it shows all the more how we need to control our language. Like I said at the beginning of the lesson, you could lose your job, you could lose your relationships, or in some very tragic, extreme cases, the things you say, the things you write, the things you draw, you could lose your life because of it. Friends, it's for freedom that Christ sets us free. He's offering you that freedom right now. Freedom from slavery to sin. Now that freedom comes with a heavy price, an obligation that is on you to use that freedom for love and service and obedience. Are you willing to accept the terms and conditions of that freedom so that you can be set free from sin this very day? Are you willing to accept the terms of Mark 16, verse 16, which says, he who believes and is baptized shall be saved? If you are willing to accept God's will for you in salvation, then please, why won't you come forward as we stand and sing?